get my shoes and out the door. 5, I'm alive. 6, 7, 8, feeling great.
Hello, BYWG Podcast Tribe. This is Dr. Noah. For the month of October, we have an awesome book of the month and product of the month that I'm incredibly excited to share with you all. As a reminder, all the links for the book and product of the month will be listed in the show notes in iTunes, in our weekly newsletters, and on our website at www.beyondyourwildestgenes.com at the Listen Now tab. Our book of the month is The Hidden Cause of Acne, How Toxic Water is Affecting Your Life and What You Could Do About It, by Melissa Gallico. I just had the incredible opportunity to interview Melissa on the podcast, and you can find this interview at www.beyondyourwildestgenes.com on iTunes, Spotify, or YouTube. The product of the month is Energy Bits. Energy Bits are 100% organic spirulina and or chlorella algae that are paleo, keto, vegan, and non-GMO. I've been taking them, as well as my family, for nearly a month, and I personally enjoy the extra added boost in nutrition and energy they provide. Watch out for our interview as well regarding the Energy Bits. You can find out more information at energybits.com. That's E-N-E-R-G-Y-B-I-T-S.com. And get 20% off forever using the code capital B, capital Y, capital W, capital G, B-Y-W-G. Enjoy the upcoming podcast. Hello and welcome back to Beyond Your Wildest Genes podcast. My name is Dr. Noah DeCoyer and I'm your co-host. Today our guest is Melissa Gallico. Melissa is the author of The Hidden Cause of Acne and F is for Fluoride. She is a former military intelligence officer, Fulbright scholar, holy moly, and intelligence specialist at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where she instructed classes for FBI analysts at Quantico and provided analytical support for national security investigators. She graduated with honors from Georgetown University and has a master's degree from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. She could be found and contacted at www.projectfree.com. Dot me. Holy moly, you are a smarty pants, Melissa. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Excellent. Like I said in the preamble, I was very thankful that our friend Dr. Guillermo Ruiz introduced us, and I'm really excited to talk about your new book, your older book. But first questions first, how about just fleshing out that bio a little bit more for our audience to get to know you a little bit better?
Sure. So I went into the intelligence field mostly because I saw this terrorism threat when I was a student at college at Georgetown in the 90s. And I just thought, that's something that I should devote my energy to. Like, that seemed like a really, a really important thing that our society was facing. And I was just drawn to that field. I studied abroad several times and that's how I ended up in the intelligence field. And fluoride and health issues weren't on my radar, really. But I did notice, just traveling back and forth so much between different countries and then different cities in the U.S., that I had really bad cystic acne when I lived in the United States. And as soon as I lived abroad, whether it was in Africa or Europe or the Caribbean, I had effortlessly clear skin. And this was such a mystery to me. The dermatologist said, I needed to take really harsh prescriptions. They put me on Accutane. They gave me these really strong creams where I couldn't even be in the sun. And it just didn't make sense to me that I would go away and my skin would clear up. Their argument was, oh, it's genetic or it's hormonal. But then why does my acne clear up when I live in Senegal or when I live in Scotland? So this just happened so many times. And the last time I spent my Fulbright year in Scotland, and I was in my 30s at this point, and my skin, was completely clear while I was there. And I just thought, okay, maybe I outgrew acne, and then when I returned to the States, I lived in Florida and it was worse than ever. And I'm in my mid 30s and it's really hard to give intelligence briefings, with face covered in acne. And so I just thought, all right, I'm an intelligence analyst, I can figure this out. And I suspected it was something in the water because certain places I would wash my face, and right away I would know if it's going to be one of those places. And very early on, I had started washing my face with bottled water when I traveled, just, you know, just in case. But I never really thought about drinking the water. And it was this that last trip when I came back from Scotland where I thought, you know, maybe it's the fluoride that they put in the water, because I had seen that when you some people have topical reactions to fluoride where they'll develop a condition called perioral dermatitis, which is just like acne, but it's like focused around your mouth. And toothpaste can cause that because of the fluoride. So it wasn't a huge leap for me to think, you know, maybe ingesting fluoride can also cause acne. And it was very easy for me to test. I just stopped drinking artificially fluoridated water. And right away, I saw a major dramatic improvement. And I thought, you know, I'm onto something. So that's kind of how I went from working in the intelligence field to being interested in health issues, first of all, and fluoride in particular. And then I started writing about it in a blog that I had, very small blog. And I was just at the initial phases of thinking, you know, maybe it's the fluoride that's causing my acne. And people would write in with comments and help me really figure it out, because I would have a flare up and I would say, you know, I'm not drinking fluoridated water. You know, what could it be? And then I'd look at what I ate in the last 24 hours, and without fail, I had eaten something that was very high in fluoride, because it's also found in a lot of foods, which hopefully we'll have time to get into a little bit later. So people helped me figure all of that out, put all the clues together. And then within about a year, I had it figured out, and my skin was completely clear, even living in the States in a fluoridated town. So the crazy thing was, I started hearing from other people who had this condition as well, and they didn't know it. They just, you know, stumbled across my blog somehow, and they're like, oh, that was the source of my acne. And I was looking at, you know, the statistics of the number of people coming to my website, and I was just thinking, this is impossible that these people all have the same crazy condition that I have, that, you know, I assumed was very rare and strange. But it turns out it's really not. I think it's very common, just based on the amount of people I've heard from who've been able to clear their acne by avoiding fluoride. So I turned it into a book. I put it on Amazon. I just thought, all right, people that are searching for answers will look on Amazon. And then I just kept getting reviews, and eventually it turned into an actual, like a publisher picked it up, and it just came out in May, called The Hidden Cause of Acne. So that kind of completed my transition into, I'm like, okay, now I need to really focus on getting the word out about fluoride and acne.
Well, so since you mentioned the book, let's go right there. And, you know, I got a copy of it. Thank you for that. And something that when I was just flipping through the first couple pages, I read a quote that you started off with, and I just wanted to touch there. And it's kind of off topic, but it means something to me as well. And it says, behind all your stories is always your mother's story, because hers is where yours begins. And as I read that, I almost tear up, because my mother is why I'm a chiropractor today, and why I help people for the last 17 years. And she died 15 years ago of colon cancer. So I was wondering if what does that quote mean to you, and why did you put that as the first part of your book?
I love that quote. It's from one of Mitch Albom's books, and I wanted to dedicate the book to my mom, because I think the reason that I am so hypersensitive to fluoride, it's shown that it bioaccumulates in your body and it stays there for decades. And when I was a child, we were on well water, and our dentist told my parents to give me a fluoride supplement, which they still do this today. Some children are given fluoride supplements, and I clearly had a negative reaction to it. I immediately started getting nosebleeds, and nobody put it together. Years later, I read that nosebleeds are a sign of fluoride intoxication. I developed dental fluorosis on my teeth, which is, you know, an indicator that my body is getting too much fluoride. I remember having trouble sleeping through the night. And we never put this together at the time. Of course, I continued to consume fluoride until my 30s. But now that I know, I know it hurts my mom to realize that she gave me something that was, you know, that was bad for me, and that caused me a lot of heartache later on. So I just wanted to dedicate the book to her, because, you know, how is she to know? Like, you know, she did the best she could. So that's kind of why I did that.
The dental field, and this was all discussed in your book, the dental field has grasped on
to fluoride as their one of their holy grails or their pillars of tooth decay prevention. Yet the evidence and the research is a little bit shoddy. And how did they even get to the point where they decided to start putting fluoride topically on teeth? And where did that all begin?
It is really a crazy story. And I had no idea when I started researching this. I had always used fluoridated toothpaste. I went to the dentist and got fluoride treatments, and I didn't know this history of it. But when I started looking into it, fluoride originally was an air pollutant. You know, it's a very common element in the Earth's crust. And when they do mining operations for aluminum plants or the fertilizer industry or all kinds of manufacturing processes, fluoride is emitted into the atmosphere. And back in the time when, you know, fluoridation began in the early 19th century and, you know, when they were thinking about doing fluoridation in like the 30s, fluoride was the leading air pollutant that was damaging agriculture, livestock, and even human health. They were being sued coast to coast wherever they would put these like aluminum smelters. And these corporations were very powerful. They were the wealthiest corporations in the world. And they hired lawyers to try to limit their liability from fluoride pollution. And the lawyers called themselves the Fluorine Lawyers Committee. Like, they were very intentional. We need to, you know, take care of this fluoride problem. They had their own medical advisory board that the lawyers would direct, and they would tell them, okay, we need science that says fluoride doesn't cause soft tissue damage. And they would conduct this study. And if it came out that fluoride does cause soft tissue damage, which it did, they did a study on 21 beagle dogs, and this study, they would just bury it. And like in this particular case, there was a journalist called Christopher Bryson. He wrote a great book about fluoride called The Fluoride Deception, and he goes on to all of this history. But he actually went to these institutes and like was looking through the files in their basement and found this study about like fluoride and soft tissue damage. He tracked down the authors of the study. He interviewed them and they said, yeah, you know, we were really concerned about this, but you know, they're just hired to conduct the research. They don't have any say in does it get published or not. And they were able to show like it was circulated among, you know, the corporate executives, but it never made it outside of that circle. So there's a lot of other examples. That's just one particular study that comes to mind, but that's why the hazards of fluoride have been suppressed. And eventually it was one of these researchers that was funded by these companies that had the bright idea of like, whoa, why don't we add it to the water? Because once they did that, it wasn't so much that they were looking for a way to dispose of their hazardous waste, although that is certainly a benefit. You know, they sell right now the fluoride that we add to our water supply. Over 90% of it is a byproduct, they call it. You know, I call it an air pollutant from the phosphate fertilizer industry, mostly here in Florida in Polk County. So instead of releasing it into the atmosphere, they barrel it, they sell it to your water supplier, and then they add it to the water, you know, at a much lower dilution rate. And that's what they say, you know, it's the dose that makes the poison. But really we don't need to be adding fluoride to the water at all, because there's much better ways to control cavities. And that's mostly through proper nutrition.
And so that's their rationale. Their rationale to add this byproduct of fluoride in the water is solely to prevent tooth decay. That's their rationale?
Yes. And originally, when they started doing it, they thought that ingesting fluoride is like consuming a nutrient in your diet, you know, a mineral that makes your teeth stronger. And they've since changed that story that, oh, okay, it's not really ingesting it. It's just the topical, you know, exposure of the fluoride to your teeth. But they never changed the medium. Like, they still put it in the water for us to ingest. And at the time, you know, it was very controversial. Fluoridated toothpaste was very controversial because they wanted to put it in the water originally. So once they got that approved, then fluoridated toothpaste got approved as well. And they thought, okay, well, you know, we'll do both. You know, why not? We'll just do both. So a lot of the studies about the effectiveness of fluoride in preventing dental decay were done before fluoridated toothpaste was in widespread use. So there's really not a good argument for continuing to put fluoride in the water. And we just do it because we've always done it, because there's so many powerful institutional reasons. Like, the entire U.S. dental establishment was is founded on fluoridation. Like the first director was the same person who did the first fluoridation trials. So it's just part of their DNA. And I think it's going to be so hard for the dental establishment to realize that they made a mistake. There are a lot of dentists who realize it, but as soon as they start speaking out about it, they're kind of labeled as, oh, you're holistic, you know, go over there. You're not mainstream right. anymore because you disagree with us. So it will be very difficult to get that mainstream core of like government dentistry to admit that this was a mistake. But I don't think we need to do that. I think we just need to stop putting it in the water.
Right. And how does it happen where I think you're in Florida. I'm in New Jersey. New Jersey does not fluoridate their water. Thankfully.
Right.
How does that happen? Because I don't think every state fluoridates their water or adds water, right?
Well, the federal government just recommends it. So they're not saying everybody has to do it. They just say, we recommend, they just lowered it a few years ago. They used to recommend up to 1.2 parts per million. And they realized that the rates of dental fluorosis were increasing so rapidly. So they lowered it. So now they recommend 0.7 parts per million. But it's up to the states. Some states have state laws like Kentucky. It's a law. You have to fluoridate your water. You know, Kentucky clearly still needs help with dental decay. They're pretty much last one of the worst states for dental decay. So fluoridation has not fixed that problem. They really need to be focusing on nutrition. But so some states like Kentucky mandate it, and other states leave it up to the local, you know, the local water council, local city councilors. Like in Florida, there's a lot of towns like my town that I live in. We don't fluoridate here, but then like right next door, they will fluoridate. So it's more of a local decision.
Right. Which I'm very happy about that. And I'm battling this out with my kids' dentists right now, my dentist for them. And I really enjoy them. I like them as dentists, but I have battled this. No, thank you. I don't want fluoride on their teeth since they were little kids. So,
yeah, that's tough. Yeah,
it is tough. And you know, you look at a back of a toothpaste bottle that has fluoride in it, and it says if you swallow more than a pea size portion, you know, call
poison control.
Poison
yeah.
control. I mean, like, so it's always blown my mind to think that something that could be so toxic is so ubiquitous. And you've kind of mentioned it in different ways, but what are the negatives of excess beyond acne? There's some sort of scientifically based connection with acne and fluoride, fluorosis, which is that coloring or modeling on the teeth. We know it's a neurotoxin. We know it competes for iodine. But are there some more real answers for parents to say, maybe I should really think twice about getting fluoride on my kids' teeth? Can you make that more real, maybe?
Well, I think the most frightening thing is what you mentioned about the neurotoxic effects of fluoride. In 2012, Harvard researchers did a meta-analysis, and they looked at 27 different studies of fluoride's effect on cognitive function. And they found, and I'll quote this, a strong indication fluoride adversely alters cognitive development in children. They recommended that this be a high research priority. And because of that, in large part, the National Toxicology Program within the Department of Health, they submitted a proposal in 2015 to study this more. And in their proposal, they say that the literature is limited in the ability to evaluate, you know, the current literature is limited in its ability to evaluate the neurocognitive effect of fluoride on children's neurodevelopment at the current drinking water guidelines, you know, set by the U.S. Public Health Service. That just blows my mind. So they're admitting we don't have enough information to fully understand how fluoride, the amount of fluoride that we add to our water supply, is affecting our children's neurodevelopment. And Harvard researchers are telling us that it is likely having an adverse effect, and yet we're still putting it in the water. So that is the number one reason not to let your children consume fluoride. These studies are very alarming, and they go back. There's been research on this for a long time, but the one that stands out to me is there was a Harvard toxicologist, Phyllis Mullenix, and she was hired to run the first dental toxicology program in the U.S. It was in Boston, Forsyth Dental Center. And her supervisor said, let's just start off with fluoride. And she thought, okay, sure, you know, that's an easy one. But then when she started looking at it, she realized her studies were done on rats, and she realized that fluoride, depending on when children are when the rats were exposed, they would react in different ways. So prenatal exposure caused hyperactivity in the rats, and postnatal exposure caused hypoactivity. So drawing from that, her research, as soon as she published in a very well-respected journal article, and you know, it was not received the way she had hoped. She thought it would start this great conversation about fluoride and neurotoxicity, and we would, you know, learn from it. But instead, she stopped receiving funding for her research, and she had to close her lab. Like, she had to leave because she couldn't do any research. But anyway, drawing from that, that's, people are looking at that as a possible reason why rates of ADHD have increased so much. And they've done epidemiological studies like showing that certain regions that fluoridate will have higher rates of ADHD. And that would be because of the prenatal exposure, whereas postnatal exposure, you know, you mentioned that it suppresses iodine. So it depresses thyroid function, which will cause hypothyroidism. So lethargy and weight issues and all kinds of problems when your thyroid gets out of balance. And there are millions of people in the United States who have hypothyroidism or subclinical hypothyroidism, just like signs of it, but it's not officially diagnosed. You know, maybe you don't like trigger, you know, a red flag in your testing, but you have symptoms of hypothyroidism. That's very common. And yet we're putting a thyroid depressant in the water supply, a proven thyroid depressant. Fluoride used to be used, and I think some places it still is used, to treat hyperthyroidism, so an overactive thyroid gland. So it's just, there's so many reasons not to let your children consume fluoride.
Yeah. I just listened to you, and this has been evident to me for quite some time, but it totally blows my mind every time I see something like this. You know, and I told you this again before we started the interview, that my father has been on board with this anti-fluoride thing way back when he was in college in the late 60s. I think he had this crazy hippie professor. He does not remember his name. He went to Guilford College in North Carolina. But, you know, he talked about it being a huge conspiracy, that it was a pollutant and that they basically needed to get rid of it some way, and they decided to put it in the water. And what I'm going to say now, I think, is it's sensitive and maybe controversial, and maybe you have an answer for this, maybe I'm way off base, but didn't the Nazis use fluoride in their camps or used it to calm or I don't even know how to say this the right way, in a negative way, like a really bad way?
I've seen reports of that online. I don't know. I haven't really seen any like concrete evidence of it. The closest thing I've seen was there was like a whistleblower in the U.S. who kept these journals, and supposedly they were showing like shipments of fluoride. But I don't know if that is a rumor or just a wild theory or if it's true. I really don't know. From my perspective, there's just so much science, like concrete science fluoride. So I never really like went down that rabbit hole of trying to get to the bottom of that. It could be true. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. It's not worth your time when there's so much just glaring in your face saying this.
Yeah,
this is a problem. Now, for us parents, or for places that don't have fluoride in their water, like I don't have fluoride in New Jersey, where else is fluoride concentrated or found readily that could cause in your case, your acne, or in some other cases, maybe hypothyroidism? Are there foods, alcohol? Like where else is fluoride found in high concentrations?
Okay, so this is a big question, and I'll give you like two main kind of buckets of sources. The first is things that are made or processed with fluoridated water. So if your water's not fluoridated, but you're drinking a lot of ready-made drinks like sodas or, you know, like even bottled health drinks, but they're made with fluoridated water, then of course, you know, that's like drinking fluoridated water. Even things that you wouldn't think of, like boxed breakfast cereals. If they were processed in fluoridated water, because of the way they're processed, a lot of times that fluoride will concentrate in the finished product. So you wouldn't think of like a boxed breakfast cereal being high in fluoride, but they can be very high in fluoride. And then the other bucket is, actually, I'll give you three buckets. Sorry, I just thought of a third.
We're good with buckets.
Okay, so the first one is things made or processed with fluoridated water. The second one is black tea. And that's really just because the tea plant is the only edible plant, pretty much, that uptakes fluoride directly from the soil in large amounts. So if you're drinking a lot of tea, black tea, iced tea, you know, instant tea, even green tea, it doesn't contain as much as black tea, but they're from the same plant. So it can be high in fluoride. And there are people who have had really bad reactions just from that one source. Like there was a study that came out earlier this year in New Zealand, and it was a woman. She had two hips replaced, or she had her knee replaced, and you know, she had really bad arthritis, and they realized, oh, she drinks tea every day, and she's been doing it like pretty much her whole life. Maybe it's not arthritis. Maybe it's like skeletal fluorosis, which is a common bone disorder endemic to areas that have naturally high fluoride in the water supply. And so she cut out fluoride. She stopped drinking tea, and her symptoms went away. So if she had known that before she had all these very intrusive surgeries, you know, it really would have helped her. And there's a lot of case studies like that. The connection between fluoride and arthritis, I think, is much more prevalent than we realize. And a lot of times people will just assume, you know, it's arthritis, and we don't really think about fluoride. But so if you're drinking tea a lot, you know, that definitely cut that out if you have like symptoms of arthritis. And then the third bucket of fluoride exposure is because fluoride is a common pesticide, which I think should be another big red flag that we shouldn't be adding it to our water supply. But they use it a lot in California, especially on grape crops. So there's this one region of California outside of Fresno that, because of these really archaic laws put in place after World War II, this region grows half the world's raisin supply. So when you have monocropping like that, you know, nature tries to intervene and restore biodiversity, and you just get some pretty nasty bug situations, and they drop millions of pounds of fluoride over these grape crops every year. And any grape products from this region can be very high in fluoride. So table grapes, anything made with grape juice, you know, they put grape juice in a lot of different kinds of juices. Wine from this region of California is very high in fluoride. And it was Europeans who noticed that, because they test for these things. And they tried to set a limit on the amount of fluoride in the wine that they were importing from California. And they couldn't meet that limit, so they tripled it. And a lot of them still had trouble meeting that limit. They tripled it to 3 parts per million, which is above the secondary contaminant level for fluoridated water in the U.S., but they still couldn't meet that limit. So you can look at the label, the pesticide label, and it says, if you're exporting this wine to Europe, you know, you can only do so many applications. Whereas if you're selling it in America, it doesn't matter. You know, you can use as much as you want. And the EPA does set residue tolerances for the amount of fluoride that is allowed to be on different crops. But the FDA and the USDA are the ones that enforce those residue tolerances. And from what I can tell, and I've dug into this as much as I possibly can online and making phone calls, no one actually tests for fluoride as a pesticide. They don't test for fluoride residue because they have so many other pesticides to test for. They have limited resources, and they just, you know, they're thinking, oh, we add this to the water. You know, it's really not worth our time to test for it as a pesticide residue. So that to me is very frightening, because, I have a pretty long section in the book about raisin toxicosis in canines. So raisins have been known to kill dogs, 100-pound dogs. And I looked at all the research from the ASPCA when they were, you know, trying to figure out what could be the cause of raisin toxicosis. I wanted to know if they had investigated fluoride pesticide. It's a pesticide called cryolite, and it's pretty much the number one pesticide used on raisins, and they have never looked into that. So I did an interview with Dr. Becker over at Dr. Mercola's website about it.
Yep.
Yeah, because I really think they need to, next time they have a dog that dies from raisin toxicosis, they need to test for fluoride poisoning, because I suspect that's what's going on, that it's actually fluoride poisoning that's killing these animals. And it's not like every box of raisins is going to be high in fluoride. It's just, who knows? You know, if nobody's testing for it and making sure that the rules are being followed, it's completely possible that, like, one of the rules with this pesticide is you're not supposed to apply it when the raisins are drying in the sun. Well, what happens if they do that by mistake? You know, they don't know the rules and they apply it when the raisins are drying in the sun for several months, just sitting there, you know, with bugs around them. Like, are they not going to spray their pesticides? So I really think we need to be looking at this. And an easy way to do that is to test a dog for fluoride poisoning. They should be able to find it, you know, pretty easily in the urine and in the plasma, and then we can know for sure.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Mercola has to have you on his regular, his regular interviews, because he's a big proponent of the Fluoride Action Network. So you need to be on his regular regular show as well, for sure.
I would love to do that. I don't know how to get in touch with them. I think my publicist like sent him a copy, but we haven't heard back. But hopefully someday.
He's not easy, I know.
Yeah.
California wine is very suspect, and I'm going to give some potential options, and I want to ask you these questions. So wine from California, grapes from California are two main things, and then black, green, white tea is very questionable as well. And I've heard that as well about how they just uptake fluoride. Now, my wife loves green tea, particularly matcha. If that, when we buy pretty high quality matcha from Breakaway Matcha, and we've had the owner of that company on the podcast, if that matcha is made in Japan, do you know if they use fluoridated water in Japan, or this is just not something that happens in Japan?
Well, it doesn't really matter about the water. It's more the soil.
Okay.
So if it's grown in soil that's high in fluoride, it could be high in fluoride. And usually, you know, soil does have fluoride, and the tea plant looks for that fluoride specifically. So that's why, like, the tea plant in particular will uptake fluoride and aluminum from the soil. I don't really know about matcha. I've had that question before. I've never had it personally, so I can't say if I've had a reaction to it. But I have been told that it's really black tea, because it's the age of the tea leaf that is the biggest variable. So black tea, definitely. I don't know if I've seen any studies about matcha.
Okay. And you said wine. Now, I only drink dry farm wine, and dry farmed wine is basically, it's all imported. The California wines don't meet their qualifications. Same question. Are wines from France and whatever, doesn't anywhere anywhere across the sea, would those grapes have fluoride higher or no? This is just, we're talking about California here.
Yeah, it's really just that one region of California. Even like Washington State and Oregon, those wines, they don't use this pesticide. And I wrote to all the different regional winery associations in California, and all the ones in Napa, Sonoma, they're like, no, we would never use that. There's a lot of concerns about it, you know, contaminating groundwater. And so it's really just this like one region of California where they tend to get, you know, cheaper wines from. So it's definitely worth, if you are going to drink wine from California, to invest in like a better winery that's not going to use this wine. But for me, to be on the safe side, I do not consume wine from California.
Right. And now grapes, I would assume it's better to consume craisins as opposed to raisins.
Yeah. That's what I tell people. Just switch to craisins. Technically, you should be okay with organic grapes and raisins as well. So they aren't allowed to use cryolite on organic crops, from what I can tell. I did see one report from the California Department of Pesticide Regulation where they said they could, but I called them and they said it was a typo. So I'm not. So I don't think you have to worry about it on organic crops.
Yeah, we eat a little bit of raisins in my house. My kids particularly like the chocolate covered ones. I'm gonna have to pay a little bit more for organic, which I have no no problem with. All right, so those are good. Those are all great options. Now, do you have, just bring it full, right back all the way around to the connection between fluoride and acne. Are there any, is there any direct science that correlates that right back to each other, or that's in the works, or that hasn't been established yet?
Well, when I first started figuring this out, that was the source of my acne, I hadn't seen any research on it. I had just seen the research about the topical applications of fluoride causing perioral dermatitis.
Right.
And then recently I read a book by an allergist named George Waldbott. He is most famous for discovering the link between emphysema and smoking. And in the 50s and 60s, he did a lot of research on fluoride. He was really a well-respected allergist. He had published journal articles, you know, in different journals from all over the world. And he was very meticulous in his research. And he did double-blind placebo-controlled studies of how his patients, you know, he had a working clinic where he treated thousands of patients, how they responded to fluoride, the amount added to the water supply. And skin eruptions was one of the very extensive list of side effects that he documented in his patients. And in the book, he also mentions research coming out of Germany about the connection between acne and fluoride. So it's out there. It's kind of hard to find. I didn't find it until recently, actually, after I wrote the book. So I am not the first person to figure this out. And now I hear from people all the time. Like I just heard from a woman today who said, you know, whenever I have someone come into my practice with acne, I say, oh, do you consume fluoride? So there needs to be more research. Johns Hopkins University did a study in 2002 of all the scientific literature on acne from the second half of the 20th century. And they found that in over 99% of these articles, they didn't even mention diet. Like dermatologists have been studying drugs. They've been studying creams. They've been studying things that you can, you know, treatments you can administer at doctor's office. They don't really have funding to just study diet. That has changed recently. In the last 15 years, there's been studies on dairy, and the paleo movement has been great because they've really looked at diet and acne. And I talk about that a lot in the book because there's a pretty famous article called Acne Vulgaris, a Disease of Western Civilization. And so they conclude that it's because of sugar. But when you look at the research, they don't actually heal their acne by getting rid of sugar. So I make the argument that they need to be looking at fluoride because I think it's, you know, it's just under the radar. It's not something that they're looking at. So they don't see it. But when I go back and read these studies, I can see like fluoride between the lines. And I'm like, we really need to study this directly.
Yeah. And I'm sure after more people read your book, there'll be more direct links on a regular basis for sure.
I would love to see those studies. That would be great.
Yep. And just the last little touch upon it, just in case any, you know, parents, mothers or young kids are listening, you know, the best way to protect yourself from cavities is it is brushing, it is flossing, it is using mouthwash that are free of fluoride. But most importantly, it's what you eat and your nutrition levels. You know, you need appropriate amounts of vitamin D and K2 and all those fat-soluble vitamins, and not consuming tons of carbohydrates and not consuming a lot of sugars. And I would assume that you would agree with what I just said, correct?
Exactly. I do.
So just if any mothers are listening out there, those are the best ways to protect your teeth and to prevent cavities. Now, I have two final questions. One is kind of a fun question. From waking to sleeping, what is your, and I ask every guest this, what is your regular routine, your daily routine?
Okay. So lately I've been quite an early riser, and that's really how I wrote the book. I would wake up by 5 and just like start writing right away because I was so excited. I would just pick up right where I left off the night before, get a few good hours in before work. I like to eat breakfast, either eggs or like green smoothie, or sometimes I'll have like a yogurt fruit bowl. My lunch is usually like leftovers from dinner. Lunches and dinners are very similar, vegetables, and I love seafood, so I try to eat that a few times a week. And then in the evenings, I live in Florida and I have a Labrador retriever. So there's a lot of pool time in the evenings. She always barks at us till we go in the pool. Trying to relax in the evenings, maybe go on a nice walk with the dog and try to be in bed by 10.
Yeah, that's great. People listen to the podcast really appreciate to listen to the guest routines, because I personally think routines and rituals are very, very important for success and to just live a very fulfilling life. So thank you for answering that question.
Sure.
And last one is, how do people find out more about your passions, your missions, your book, website, the whole thing?
My website is projectfree.me. And I have two books now. The first is called The Hidden Cause of Acne. And then I wrote a little book. It's a it's kind of a children's book style, but it's intended for adults. It's called F is for Fluoride, A Feasible Fairy Tale for Free Thinkers 15 and Up. Mm-hmm. And I wrote that one because readers of my first book all of a sudden are trying to avoid fluoride. And they're like, oh, is it in this wine? Is it in this water? And their family thinks they're crazy. And I know that from personal experience, because that's what happened to me. So I wanted to make this little easy to read book that you could just like give to your friend who's like, what is wrong with you? Like, why are you trying? Why is fluoride such a big deal? And it explains like the pollution history. It explains the health effects, and it all rhymes. And there's like a limited number of words per page. So you can pick that up, or you can actually see it on YouTube. I have a petition to end fluoridation, and there's a link on my website. So projectfree.me, it'll take you to the petition. And at the top, there's a video version of this book, F is for Fluoride. So it's like a lecture by a fish, and she's talking about fluoride. You can reach me there. I also have a private Facebook group if you want to collaborate on how to avoid fluoride in your diet or how to get it out of your water supplies. Politically, we do a lot of brainstorming. I just launched that a few weeks ago, and it's been great. People are very active in there. And then I'm also on Instagram and Twitter. Been trying that out. Melissa Gallico.
Yeah. Oh, one quick question just popped in my mind. The only way to remove fluoride is through reverse osmosis in your home. Correct? Is that correct?
Oh, there are other ways, other types. I usually recommend that just because it's the most common, but okay. You could use like activated alumina will remove fluoride. Certain systems have like very specific filters for it. Some people don't like reverse osmosis because it takes out all the minerals. So you'd either have to add them back in or, make sure that you're getting your minerals somehow.
Great. I just wanted to, that just popped in my mind, and that's important as well. Yes. I have a whole house filter as well, but fortunately for fluoride, I don't need it. Thank God. Well, thank
right.
you.
Right. Yeah, you're lucky.
I know. Thank you so much for your time. Melissa, I really appreciate this. Just keep doing what you're doing. It's important work.
Thank you. I will. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. My name is Dr. Noah DeCoyer, your co-host, and you are listening to the Beyond Your Wildest Genes podcast. If you like what you've heard today, please share this with your friends and family and encourage them to subscribe on iTunes. All the links to the books and to the website, all that stuff will be in the show notes and in our weekly email. And as my oldest son Hayden says, be awesome and never unawesome.
One, two, three, four, get my shoes and out the door. Five, I'm alive. Six, seven, eight, feeling great.